Hi, everyone. You're listening to Pharmacy Focus Oncology Edition, where we bring you the latest trends in the oncology pharmacy space. I'm your host, Alex Gerlach, and today we'll be listening in on another segment from our Pharmacy Times peer exchange discussion about antibody-drug conjugates and HER2 breast cancer. In this episode, our experts will talk about how real-world clinical data compares with clinical trial data for approved ADCs, and they'll also share supportive care approaches for managing the toxicities associated with these agents. So, without further ado, I'll pass it over to our pharmacists.
So moving on, Dr. Hill, in your experience, how do real-world data and patient experiences compare with clinical trial results for the approved antibody-drug conjugates that we currently have on the market?
Yeah, thank you. So I think a lot of institutions are currently looking at their inpatient populations and the real world, both outcomes and safety of ADCs in those particular patient populations. For the most part, the outcomes and the side effects appear to be pretty similar to what we're seeing in the prospective clinical trials. We are seeing some places where progression-free survival may be shorter in a more heavily pretreated patient population, and that makes sense. Specifically for SG, a couple of trials that the real world data that I think is very helpful in clinical practice, even though it's very small patient populations, seeing that even though in the real world setting you have higher instances of dose reductions but same outcomes, that's helpful. It makes us feel more comfortable when we have a patient that's having difficulty tolerating it, that that dose reduction isn't going to impact its efficacy more than likely, as well as there's some data reported where patients that receive GCSF stay on SG longer. And so it makes perfect sense, but it's just nice to have that in black and white and for us to kind of have some support of saying, yes, they may have some additional side effects by adding this GCSF, but it's going to help them stay on SG longer, which will ultimately benefit them. And then just from my personal experience, I think that it's when drugs are first approved, it's a little bit challenging because they do tend to be more heavily treated than the clinical trial patients. So you start to see maybe a little bit more side effects, but then as they're out longer and we start using them in earlier lines or kind of less sick patients, they do start to look a little bit more like the clinical trial patient populations and what is published from those large prospective trials. Dr. DeMarco, what are you seeing in your patient population and real world studies that you've looked at that you find interesting or can compare to our clinical trial data?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I think you just really explained it perfectly. I don't have much to add. I completely agree. The only thing that I'll say is that there is real world data for sequencing these ADCs out there. And I think, I mean, I can't speak for all my colleagues on this panel, but I think it's really difficult to, you know, interpret and apply to patients in clinic because every patient is different and we're kind of treating patients with sequencing right now based off patient characteristics and, you know, what we think they'll tolerate best. And that doesn't always fit with one clinical trials or one what this real world data is reporting. I think we've mentioned several times, we know that progression-free survival gets shorter with each subsequent line of therapy. And that's definitely been seen in the real world data. I see it every day in clinic. But it has been, you know, particularly difficult to kind of translate those results for these patients. So really, I think we just need true clinical trial data to help us to kind of guide us. But then we'll still have those patients who have already received one ADC. And, you know, what do you do next? So I think there's still a lot of questions to be answered.
Yeah, thank you both. I think you both brought up great points in terms of how do we extrapolate some of the prospective clinical data that we have into our everyday real world patients, patients that otherwise may have been excluded or patients that may have been underrepresented, and think it's really helpful. How do we extrapolate those results to our everyday clinical practice? So both of those are, you know, great points. Thank you. And along some of those lines, and I think you guys did a great job of hitting on some of those, but Dr. Taraba, what practical considerations do you think pharmacists should be aware of when administering antibody drug conjugates? I know that we've touched on this a little bit, but thinking along the lines of doses, pre-medications, and even drug interactions is, along with some other supportive care, what are your thoughts around this?
Yeah, I think pre-medications, and it was touched on earlier too with that risk of nausea and vomiting. I think when T-DXd was first approved, I think it was came out as a moderately emetogenic therapy, and I think we were kind of used to seeing adotrastuzumab and pansy, which has very minimal nausea and vomiting, and we're a little bit surprised when we did see how much nausea and vomiting we did see with T-DXd, and now has been upgraded to a highly emetogenic regimen along with sacituzumab. So I think really making sure patients have the appropriate antiemetics on when starting them on therapy and supportive care post-treatment as well. As far as dosing, when we look at T-DXd, it's approved in a number of indications, and there are different doses, starting doses. And so I think one of the things is really educating, providers on, in our breast patient population, as well as like the lung cancer population, starting at that 5.4 versus 6.4, and really utilizing, ensuring that your treatment plans and things are there to make sure we're selecting the right dose. Looking at this, dosing schedule, T-DXd, as well as Dato-DXd are, once every 3 weeks, whereas that sacituzumab has that day one and eight, treatment cycle. So things to consider, especially patients with difficulty with transportation and those things. And then also incorporating, that pharmacogenomic component with this SG and that UGT1A1 testing. I don't know how many sites are routinely doing it. I know we have a handful of providers that are doing it as well. And knowing that, those homozygous UGT1A1 STAR 28 patients do have that increased risk for both neutropenia and anemia and other side effects. So something to consider as well when starting patients on that. Dr. Hill, I don't know if you have any other thoughts from your end on or suggestions, things that you evaluate prior to starting patients.
No, I think those were all things that we kind of try to consider and keep in mind with all of these agents. Some of the like logistical types of things that I don't, necessarily take into consideration when starting them, but once they're started are things that we kind of think through and work with our colleagues in the more dispensing space. Is how long they're good for can sometimes be challenging, especially with those first infusions and if you're a kind of a busier center. So for T-DXd and Dato-DXd, they're only good for 4 hours, including prep time and infusion time. And so it kind of really mashes that window of time to get it from when it's made to the start of the infusion to be not very long. And so for our colleagues in that space, it is a challenge for them to make sure that it's getting to the nurses and getting hung on time. And then another kind of like logistical thing that comes up with all of the ADCs, because they are so costly and the monitoring is so costly, is of course insurance coverage. So as we're talking about some of the supportive care things that we do, like G-CSF, and then something that will probably come up later in the discussion with some institutions doing 6-week CT scans to monitor for ILD, things that insurances may not want to cover because they're not necessarily proven standard of care at this point. Those sort of logistical things with these agents are also things that I try to keep in mind with these newer antibody drug conjugates that can be more costly and have some extra monitoring and just some extra things to try to keep track of in the clinic, I guess.
Those are all great points. I don't know about you guys, but what I found with T-DXd especially is more so delayed nausea into that second week. And I found that a lot of patients tend to do well with relapidin. It's like if we've kind of exhausted everything else, we have found that relapidin, because it's a longer acting NK1, can be helpful for those patients. I don't know if you guys have used that in that space too, but has been something that's been helpful for our patients. When we're thinking about current ADCs in this space, we've talked quite a bit about their toxicity profiles and how toxic these agents are. But Dr. Hill, what supportive care agents do you utilize when treating with ADC therapy? I guess that was a good role in there with orlapinant. What other things have you utilized for some of these agents?
Yeah, that is very true, and I think a lot of institutions probably flux things a little bit based off of patients' prior experiences, right? So a lot of these patients have received prior therapies, and so what I'll kind of go over what we standardly do, but we're often adapting that based off of how they have tolerated their previous treatments as well. So for T-DXd, we start with a triplet antiemetic regimen, and then add olanzapine if they need it or if previously they struggled more with nausea. But it obviously would be perfectly reasonable to just start up front with the four drug regimen as well, based off of, how highly emetogenic it can be. We don't currently do the 6 week CT chest in between our PET scans to look for ILD. We do very aggressive symptom monitoring, but to catch that grade one ILD, you wouldn't unless you're doing those 6 week CT chest. And so that's definitely something that I think, depending on the institution and the patient, can vary a lot. And then, of course, like ongoing clinical trials, they all do the 6 week CT chest. For SG, similar antiemetics, we do a triplet and then just add olanzapine. We don't currently have scheduled loperamide at home or atropine as a pre-medication, but we do add those on kind of on a more patient-specific basis. We do utilize upfront G-CSF in all of our patients with SG. We kind of talked about how frequent the neutropenia is with this agent and how patients can stay on it longer if they receive G-CSF. At our institution, we do the long acting on day eight, but a lot of institutions do the short acting on day one and day eight. I will say, by doing it on day eight, for cycle one, day eight, we do have some delays because at that point they haven't gotten any growth factor yet. So if you were to do it on day one, you would kind of prevent some of that. But for our patient population, it's just a little bit easier for them to do the long acting as opposed to the short acting. And then from like an infusion reaction standpoint, we do the typical acetaminophen, famotidine, diphenhydramine. We initially started with doing a 3 hour and then a 2 hour and then a 1 hour, since the labeling says, after the first one, you can do one to two. And then after a while, we just started going straight from a 3 hour infusion to a 1 hour infusion for SG. We've not had any issues with that, but I'd be curious if other people kind of do that and what their experience has been. The other thing that we have started to do with SG is eliminate that post-infusion observation. If they tolerate the fastest rate okay, they don't want to hang around. And I don't know that it's super necessary once we've proven they can tolerate it to do that indefinitely. So we eliminate that as well. Obviously, with Dato-DXd being much newer, we have a lot less experience with it. But we do the same triplet antiemetic, the same pre-medications to prevent infusion reactions as we do with SG. Kind of the unique things with it are going to be the preventative, like cryotherapy and dexamethasone mouthwash for that stomatitis mucositis risk. A lot of the trials kind of left it up to the provider as to whether they did it up front or added it. We do upfront, like we don't wait for someone to struggle with mucositis or stomatitis. We will just do the cryotherapy and the dex mouthwash on everyone. And then the lubricating eye drops, obviously, everyone gets per the labeling as well.
Awesome. That's a great overall review. I think that hit pretty much on all of the big toxicities that we think about when utilizing these agents and some of the supportive care measures that we can put into place to help mitigate or manage a lot of those. Incredibly helpful. You mentioned allergic reactions. Dr. Taraba, kind of further going through that discussion, in your practice, how do you address the potential for infusion-related reactions? And if they happen, how do you manage their occurrence? So I'd be curious to know, like, how do you explain this to patients? How do we mitigate them? How do you manage them?
Yeah, a lot of those, what Dr. Hill had mentioned as well, just those pre-medications, that Tylenol, Benadryl with the first infusion. as well as, the ones for sacituzumab with each infusion. Again, all the rescue medications that are available, sometimes stopping the infusion, slowing the infusion, those type of things. We also, too, in patients that have not had a infusion reaction, have looked at omitting those observation times as well, and so have updated our sacituzumab. So a lot of the similar things that Dr. Hill alluded to. Dr. Hunter, do you have any other things that you do at your site?
No, I think from the perspective of the infusion reactions, like everything is pretty consistent. I will add, as she was talking about the supportive care and when they do the growth factors at the institution, we have the standard, like day nine, if you will, or if you have Onpro and it's an on-body device, day eight, long acting. But if we have patients that have had a history, we utilize the short acting on day two, three, four, and then 9, 10, 11, do more short acting. And of course, that's very cumbersome for our patients who are having to come back to the clinic because I practice in Texas Medical Center, which is usually like an hour away from anywhere in Houston. So it's not a nice drive. So that's when some of those social determinants of health that we'll talk about a little later on and access to care come into play if their prescription insurance can actually cover that. And with the infusion reactions, we do, have a re-challenging titration protocol set with a 25%, 50%, and 75% titration if we do try to re-challenge them if they report symptoms, as well as, of course, the availability of all of your standard hypersensitivity reaction medications with oxygen and H1, H2 antagonists, hydrocortisone. So all of those things are there. I will say I have a few patients right now that are getting sassy and they have to get the 3 hour infusion of foot. So they're having to deal with, having that longer infusion because they did when we did, even when we rechallenged them, kind of reported some symptoms. So we do like to start off with that rapid one if we can, like, do the titration to 3 hours, and then the next time bring them back and do one. But we've had a few that we had to stay with a 3 hour infusion coincidentally, and they do still tolerate it. I usually give them pre-medications 24 hours before if they've had that infusion reaction. I'll give them some steroids and H1 and H2 antagonists 24 hours before for them to take if they report that they had that they had the infusion reaction and we're having to give them the 3 hour infusion.
Those are all great insights. I think it's really helpful when we think about how we're incorporating some of the more basic concepts, even of just infusion, with some of these agents.
Thanks for joining us for this installment in the series. We have another episode coming to you next week where our experts will cover toxicity monitoring for ADC therapy and share how they optimize these treatments within their clinics. So take care and see you next time.